When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk Splits, a show where we bring back two former guests of the show that may or may not know each other for a conversation. And what an episode we have for you today, because returning to the show, two of my favorite guests ever. And I'm not just saying that, I really do, when I reflect back on this show, think, oh my God, these guys have got to come back at some point. And here they are together, David Bazan and Ben Gibbard from Pedro the Lion and Death Cab for Cutie, respectively. And two good friends outside of this show. So this is a very fun conversation where we nerd out. My gosh, do we nerd out. The show, as always, brought to you by myself and my producer, my guest booker extraordinaire, my little baby brother, Tristan Abraham. And this was actually his idea. This was his brainchild. David Bazan hit up the show and about coming back on, and we were like, for this new record, this fantastic new record that he's got. And Tristan's like, I think we should get Ben Gibbard back on. And I was like, okay, well, I'll see what's up. Texted Ben, and Ben said, of course. And so here we are. So if you've got anyone to thank for this coming together, you got to thank Tristan and Dave and Ben. I guess I'm involved in it a little bit too. But Tristan, this was his brainchild. So thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for this show. He runs the email address for this podcast, which is turnedoutapunk@gmail.com. He also runs a Instagram page for this thing at turnedoutapunk. There's a TikTok page, a YouTube page. Check out the YouTube page because there's video for all these episodes now. I stay up very late editing these videos. It takes fucking forever to edit video. And you can go watch those things. Please watch those things over at YouTube, at Turned Out a Punk on YouTube. There's also I think that's it. There's stuff for Turned Out a Punk all over the place. And you can reach out to Tristan on the email address, and he will get the message to me. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamian. Supporting this show is done by telling all your friends about it. You can also check out the band I plan. I plan a band called Fucked Up. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc or at Fucked Up on social media. And you can check us out on tour. We're going to be going out on tour playing Merge 35 with Red Cross and Mountain Goats. What an awesome show. We're also going to be playing the last off show of Bittersweet, but I'm sure a fantastic time. I think both of those might be sold out. But there's lots of other shows on that tour. So if we're coming to a town near you, come and hang out and let's talk about this podcast. And I'll play some music and yell into a microphone as well. All right, on to today's show. Let's talk about that for a second because I want you to hear this episode. I don't want to go rambling on forever. And this one's a fantastic one. As I said off the top, David Bazan and Ben Gibbard are returning to the show. And this is, you go back and listen to their first two appearances on this show, there's a real, real deep head kind of level of analysis of punk rock that both these guys do on their own. So to be able to tap into that and commiserate and conversate about punk rock and hardcore, I can't think of two better people to do it with. And then the fact that they know each other and go so deep in each other's history, but also come at this thing being punk rock, from kind of two similar but different backgrounds completely, and different perspectives and wind up at times, well, no, always kind of inspiring each other, but then even at times like doing stuff together. It's a fascinating conversation. Anyway, you're going to hear, why am I selling it to you? You're listening to, if you're listening to this, you're definitely going to be listening to the rest of this podcast. They both have records out. As I said, there's a fantastic new Pedro the Lion record called Santa Cruz. And as always, everything Dave Bazan does, Pedro the Lion being one of the projects that he does, but kind of the main project he does, is fantastic. And this is no exception. This thing is out now wherever you want to pick it up. But he is on tour right now and playing all over the United States and dipping into Canada even and doing some stuff. So check out PedroTheLion.com for more show details and where you can get your tickets and to see it, because Dave's also playing drums on this tour. He's doing like the Satanic Surfers thing. Yes, I know there were other singing drummers, but let's be honest. There's no one better than the Satanic Surfers that did that singing drummer thing. At the same time, I mean. It's like just wild. But Dave's doing it. Maybe Dave does the Satanic Surfers jumps. Anyway, go check out Pedro the Lion on tour now. Death Cab for Cutie has just gotten off this sort of massive, massive tour with Postal Service, which is also Ben's other project, if you didn't know, with drums as well. And they are still playing shows. They've got some shows coming up at the end of the month or end of August, it looks like, in Europe, and so maybe a festival date somewhere in the United States, it looks like. You can find out more information at the deathcabforcutie.com website. And they also have a great record that is well worth checking out, Asphalt Meadows, as both Ben and Nick from Death Cab for Cutie were on the show to talk about. Actually, no, Ben was on before that. Nick was on for this record. So check out Nick's episode, too. That's a fantastic conversation. It'd be really fun to be on tour with Death Cab for Cutie. You could have deep head punk conversations on that bus. And Pedro the Lion as well. You're going to hear one right now. I'm excited for you to hear this. I think that's it for me. All right. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the return of David Bazan and Ben Gibbard to Turned Out a Punk Splits. Ben, Dave, Ben, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having us back.
Well, this is a kind of a dream conversation to have, because both of you actually mention each other on your episodes as being key early friendships you kind of establish at the Paradox. And so I'm excited to get to talk to you about that. But is that the first time you guys really met? Would it be through going to shows at the Paradox?
It was, my memory is it was in Bellevue at Ground Zero the first time we played. Maybe it was August 98. Is that possible, Ben?
I think that's exactly right. And I remember, what I remember about that show was that it was us, you guys, and 764 Hero. And I was working this job in Bellingham. I was working a job that I had to be at like at 6 a.m. That was when my shift started. So we did that thing, that annoying thing that bands do sometimes, where we go to one of the other bands and ask to play first so we can leave, right? So I went to Dave. So I was the one, because I was the one who had to go to work. I went to Dave, who I'd never met before. And I'm like, hey, man, what's your guys, Pedro the Lion? Listen, man, do you guys mind playing if we play first? Because like, I got to leave and go to this thing. I remember the look on Dave's face was just like, fuck, are you serious, man? Like this guy. And like, but you were like, really, you're like, sure, whatever. And then I left to go because I'd be at work in the morning. And then Chris Walla, our guitar player, was like, you guys fucked up, because that band Pedro the Lion was amazing. And like, you know, I think he bought your guys' record at that point and brought it back. And, you know, we've been friends ever since, even though I pulled that move in our very first meeting.
Yeah, I think it was intimidating more than anything for me, because you guys like boogied from the beginning, and we were definitely, I think we were a two piece that night without a bass player. And so it was it was like a much more somber thing. And so when we watched you guys play, I was like, yeah, because it was the thing too. We had just through some friends, I just heard of this band, Death Cab for Cutie. Like, you know, when we heard that we had this booking, and our friends that lived in a house that we lived in, they were like, oh my God, have you heard this band? And I was just, you know, my band starting to take off for the first time, and then like these other guys, and then I watched you guys play, and I was like, damn, these guys are really. And then I got your record, and yeah, and then I think in September we played at the Velvet Elvis together. Maybe like it happened pretty.
Yeah. Yeah, we ended up doing a lot of I feel like it felt like we were doing a show with you guys like every other month, it felt like, at that time. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, though, you guys might have met before that, because there's a certain Coolidge show that opened for Earth Crisis. Right, Dave?
Is that – I mean, in somebody's house, I think we did open for Earth Crisis. That might have been – I don't recall being aware of anything before August.
Because there's a, it's listed on your band's discography, for Coolidge's discography, I mean, that you guys played with Earth Crisis, and I think you brought up last time. And Ben, as you and I have discussed, there was an infamous yogurt bombing at an Earth Crisis show that you were present at, and I was wondering if it was by chance the same Earth Crisis Washington area show.
Well, no, I have to correct the record. I was not at the show, but I know the way the story was told to me was that an old friend of mine named Dan Modiak, a high school friend, who was a vegan and a straight edge kid, had brought some like slices of Velveeta cheese and thrown it at Earth Crisis. That's the way I had heard it, and that the show was stopped, and he was brought forward and scolded for this act. And you know, I've never gotten down to the bottom of whether or not this actually happened or not. It's like one of those things, like before people were, everything was being filmed on people's phones and stuff. Like you don't really know, but, what I remember about Dan from our time in high school together was that he is exactly the kind of guy who would have done this, right? The kid who was like a believer in the movement, but wanted to still kind of like, you know, kind of like bring some kind of sardonic irreverence to the seriousness of something like that. I'm actually curious, Dave, what that show was like for you guys opening for Earth Crisis.
It was in a house or like an apartment. And as you're talking about it, I vaguely have a memory of there being some kind of drama at the Earth Crisis part. But what stuck out for me is like, I'm a relatively new drummer. I haven't been playing in bands, period. Like I played in church a lot. There was some thrasher dude in Paradise, California that I had like three rehearsals with, but the band with Gerardo, and this might've even been an early version of Coolidge. It might've been the Guilty was the name. And so what I took away is that the Earth Crisis drummer pulled me aside and he was like, you're rad, but let me just say, like, you don't always have to play the verse on the hi-hat and the chorus on the ride cymbal. Like, you can, like, mix it up. Because I was, like, so serious, like, playing what I thought, like, you know, I was not being very creative about the drum parts that I was writing. And it was amazing that that guy did that. And so I didn't feel, like, chastised or anything. I just wanted information about, like, more about how to make art, I guess is what it was. But, and this guy pulled me aside and was just like, you're doing great, but like, you're going to kill everybody if you keep on going to that ride every single, cause it was also a Sabian B8 Pro ride. I don't know if that means anything to anybody, but they sound rough. I mean, it's like ding, 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 ding. And the guys, and I think they might've actually suggested to the drummer to pull me aside, but then I got to watch him drum, and you know, just blown away every time you see somebody who's real doing it. It's like, okay, I see some things.
The protesting at Earth Crisis shows was like a very common thing back then, I think, because they had that pro-life leaning song on the first 7-inch, which they did apologize for on the second pressing of that 7-inch, to be noted. But they, like, there were like tons of shows where there's that famous one that I think got written about in Alternative Press magazine, where the lead singer of Ink and Dagger yogurt bombed them with yogurt from the back of the room, and vegan as well, or like people showing up and throwing various things at them, disrupting their shows. It seems like that would not be a very pleasant band to tour in.
Yeah, that seems rough.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, it's a little bit of like live by the sword, die by the sword kind of situation, right? I mean, you know, you know, I feel that I maybe I'm remembering this wrong too, because my brain is Swiss cheese, but I feel like I got into a little bit of a weird Twitter spat with Earth Crisis from like the early days of Twitter. Like, I don't know what it was about. I really can't remember what it was, but I made some joke about Earth Crisis and then Earth Crisis responded. It was a classic, like context collapse situation where like, oh, I didn't realize these guys would actually hear what I said. And I don't think it was nothing like, I wasn't like, fuck Earth Crisis or something like that. It was just some joke I made and whatever. But I think that that's kind of one of the elements that comes with being a band that has such a, whether or not they are intensely serious people, they come across as being intensely serious about the causes they believe in, right? And that's to be admired, to be that earnest and that kind of principled. But it also means that you are really opening yourself up to people fucking with you, and how you respond to being fucked with will kind of be a part of your story, if that makes sense.
It's make or break. I mean, you are being confrontational if you're having a stand that way. That's a part of your public facing. And sometimes especially in like punk and hardcore, there's a scolding kind of aspect that can be a part of it. And then at that point you are, you know, you're being confrontational and you're asking for heckling and these things in a way that can be so exciting, you know. Like Fugazi, you know, I think was a fun band to watch because they just would be like, you know, get out of here or fuck you, or like, I saw you eating ice cream, or just make fun of whoever it was. I felt like they handled hecklers pretty well.
There's like a pre-internet Ian MacKay conspiracy theory that they brought that kid that would fuck up the Fugazi show as a plant, and he was part of the payroll, and that's why Ian would always have the $5 in the denomination of the country he was in.
That's showbiz, man. That's awesome.
Oh my God. That's amazing. What an amazing theory.
Oh, it'd be so great if that were true. But I think it also speaks to how upsetting some of these bands are. And I think some of these bands were fighting different fights, obviously, but Bikini Kill, the kind of confrontation that they would meet at shows and sort of like how threatened people were by them, or, you know, certainly Fugazi as well, was sort of like the idea of like, no, you can't celebrate this music the way you have celebrated up until now because it's intrusive on other people. Like, we want you to kind of do it differently. That upset so many people. Propagandhi as well. Like there's a bunch of bands in the 90s that were being pretty real with it and probably met with a lot of praise, but certainly a lot of flack.
Yeah.
Both you coming from different kinds of households, but households which had like, I don't want to say authoritarian, but certainly like a principled kind of approach, Ben being military and Dave, you're being more religious. Because like talking to Nick, when Nick was on the podcast from Death Cab, he was saying how you and him, Ben, when he thinks about it, there was a connection that came out of being sort of like military brats or the children of parents in the military, and kind of like, you know, yourself, Dave, too, coming from a religious background where there, or a religious household, I should say, where there is that sort of like, there's rules and just sort of your reactions to it. I was just wondering if that, you know, you thought that brought you together or how that affected the relationship.
I don't know. I mean, you know, I one of the things I really admired, I still to this day, obviously admire about Dave, but, you know, Pedro the Lion, from our perspective, when they put out It's Hard to Find a Friend, they were just gone on tour. You guys were touring all the time. And we really admired collectively in Death Cab how Dave and Pedro the Lion were just like, we put out a record and we're going to work. We're going to go out. We're going to tour. This is how we're going to, and, you know, I don't know, you know, I'm sure you guys weren't making much money at that point, but you were basically making it your job. And that was really inspiring to us because I think that, you know, I think the hardest thing to do as a band is really to kind of just get that push out of the nest of like, okay, we're going to make a real go at this. We're going to suffer. We're going to not sleep. We're not going to eat properly. We're going to play to nobody. We're going to crash on, you know, cat shit, fucking floors, whatever. Like, and, you know, I think that, you know, if to your question, Damien, I think probably one of the things we both bonded over was, I think that maybe these kind of very structured upbringings that Dave and I had, you know, were beneficial to us kind of starting out and having, and, you know, eating shit the way that bands have to eat shit when they first kind of start off.
I mean, being in a town or a scene or whatever you want to call it with bands who are your peers, and you kind of, you know, we just were lucky. Our first records came out at the same time. And so I got to watch, you know, we obviously had like our approach, which, you know, was that it was like none of this is going to come for free. Like, we have to work hard. And I saw the same thing with Death Cab in various ways. And like, whenever we would put out another record, just sort of that combination of like, damn, like when I put on We Have the Facts the first time, and there's that switcheroo where the hi-fi comes in after the first chorus on
title track.
Yeah. I remember being so like crestfallen in a way. It's that combination of like so much admiration, and like as a music fan, you're just like, this rips. But then it was my friends having this killer idea, and it just we're just like, fuck. Like, I got to keep, like, it was inspiring to dig deeper, not to like be like them, but to be like me more, the way that I saw them do it. And like, yeah, just like work ethic. You just see how your friends operate, and like hearing about the way that you guys would do, like one person always slept in the van, like on those early tours to like keep things safe. I thought, man, that is hardcore. Like, I don't want to do this. I don't, you know, but you guys had like that was how it was, you know, and your like money orders, the way that you guys like handled like the business part of it. I think every time you see anybody who's kind of serious about it, we all have our different little schemes that we come up with that are like how to make it work. And like seeing how you guys did it, I was always like taking little notes. And yeah, I mean, we were both really serious about wanting to do this, you know, and each had our own approach and our own things that we were trying to express, you know, and similar overlapping tastes. And then like, I never knew about Teenage Fan Club until basically you were just like, yo, this is like my favorite band at some point. And so then, yeah, there was just all that kind of cross-pollination happening. And it was a thrill. It was really exciting.
It's interesting how there's like, you know, because Ben, last time you talked about, there was like sort of this divide that you felt between your scene and what the MXPX guys were doing. And Nate actually said on an episode that still is yet to be finished from the Foo Fighters that, you know, when he joined Sunny Day Real Estate, there was a little bit of blowback from his friends in Christ on a Crutch, because there was a palpable divide between sort of secular and non-secular punk music at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was listening to another podcast series recently that was, there was a number of interviews with a dude who was in like a Christian punk band. And, you know, as we talked about in the last episode, there was this kind of, coming up in the scene in the 90s, there was this kind of idea that like, you know, people were almost outed for being like Christian, like, and not even if they weren't like, they weren't writing praise music. It was just like, did you hear that this guy's Christian? What the fuck? And, you know, as I said in the last episode, it felt like, you know, one can kind of debate the validity of the terms Christian and punk being put together. But, you know, we've seen the combinations of other things that probably shouldn't be punk either. Like the idea of like Krishna core, like, you know what I mean? Like what, that's like such an odd combination of like this spiritual movement and like a punk ethos. And like, well, I kind of came to this conclusion, like really you could, any things you want to combine, as long as you're kind of maintaining this ethos of independence and, you know, you have a liberation kind of like philosophy behind what you're doing, you know, it's still a little goofy to me, but like I've become a lot more tolerant of the concept from the time I was younger.
I feel like the line that I see things along are kind of propaganda versus art, which is obviously not a hard line. There's a lot of bleed. And within punk, I think within the so-called punk sort of movements and genre, that there is a lot of bands who are making propaganda more than they're making what I would say is art. Maybe that's a horrible like framing, but for me, the first release that Pedro the Lion made was called The Whole EP. Coincidentally, was on Tooth and Nail Records. And from my vantage point, it was propaganda. Like I was taking like the Christian story, because I thought that was my task as like a Christian person who was making music. I grew up that it was like about the message and less about the music, or less about personal expression and more about putting the theology that you grew up with, or like the sort of story of salvation, into a context that people could consume musically. And so the Whole EP was that, you know, it was framed differently. It's sort of a, you know, what would it be? A sheep in wolf's clothing, maybe. But it was basically like the gospel story in five songs. And then I got done with that and I just kind of like, fuck, do I have to keep doing this for the rest of my songwriting career? Like, I don't want to. This is kind of dumb. And so I worked really hard to get the freedom personally to just make things that I wanted to make that were reflections of what was going on with me, and not catering to, not saying anything I was supposed to say, or some, not saying anything that was directly in line with whatever movement or whatever I was a part of. And so for me, I mean, I was a person who grew up Christian. I kind of cut my teeth in the Christian, you know, playing Christian shows with other Christian bands. And I desperately wanted to just be out of that cloister. I didn't know if I would be accepted or not, but I didn't want to participate in that, you know, scene of mostly propaganda music. That wasn't what I liked to listen to. It wasn't interesting to me. And so for me, you know, the lasting sense of punk is this thing that you're talking, that you said just now, Ben, like liberation and independence. And for me, it is self-expression that is beyond, you know, propaganda, which is sort of just like retelling things that everybody already knows. And, you know, I couldn't stop talking about Fugazi last time I was on your podcast. It was like, it was a verbal tick for like 90 minutes. But, you know, they're an interesting case because they do, like, if you look at the stances that they take and that find their ways into the music, I think they find creative ways of presenting it that helped me understand and did come from a place of self-expression. But there is that fine line there, I think, between propaganda and art. And within punk, it's, you know, I think the real sense of punk is, you know, to make self-expressive music that holds to these kind of ideals of just, you know, not just independent like music, which I don't even think it matters like where you put your records at, is that you are an independent thinker who makes what you want to make.
Well, I think last time, Dave, you were on the show, you actually first kind of planted the seed in my head of punk being sort of like secular religious music. Totally. And Fugazi's kind of making propaganda music for this cult that we're all in. Like, they're singing things and things that I love, and I'm glad they were singing about these things, but, you know, be it body politics, be it
reclamation,
yeah, or merchandising politics, or like just sort of like what they're singing about are ultimately values that are beholden to this church called punk rock. Like, and
Suggestion is a great example to me from 13 songs. I didn't really understand. I mean, it took me two more decades to, and am continuing to understand how misogyny works and how objectification of not just women, but all of our bodies and sexuality. But like, that's, it opened my eyes in a profound way. And so it's, yeah, I, I'm not saying that all propaganda is bad either, but there is like, that is how I tend to see, you know, things. And especially when I'm making, because I have issue driven moments, you know, in my tunes, and I try to be like, yeah, it's an interesting question. And it does strike me that it was that way for me. I needed that when I came out of Christianity, you know, or not even out of Christianity, as I was just getting out of that music and out of that music scene, something that had some meaning beyond just like what pop music might present. It really satiated me. Also kind of radicalized me. You know, I grew up a conservative kid, or a kid in conservative environments, and it was Fugazi songs that were like, oh, I'm going to have to reserve judgment about that for a little while longer. It was really good.
Yeah, like in the same way religion provides people with a moral code, I got that from punk rock. And I think we talked about it with all of us together different times, but together last time, because that's a great thing about punk rock, which is the same thing that religion provided for society in a lot of ways, is giving people sort of the moral code of thou should not kill, thou should not steal, just good governing principles. And in the same way punk rock, it's like thou shalt do it thyself, thou shalt be suspicious of corporation. I'm like, you know, that we've these tenets too in our religion.
I think the only danger is too strong a word, but I think the thing that I've always tried to kind of maintain perspective on is, I think it is dangerous to trade one extreme dogma for another, right?
Totally.
And, you know, I think that, I mean, as we talked on the show last time, Damien, we were talking about, you know, kind of growing up, and when I was growing up around a lot, I mean, I was straight edge, but I wasn't kind of X's on the hands. You know, I'd go to some of the shows, but I was kind of, I even at a young age, I was kind of alarmed at my friends who kind of were rejecting, kind of, not that I cared that they were rejecting traditional religion, but rejecting traditional belief systems and buying completely into this new one with a similar sense of fervency and dogmatic kind of belief, like an unwavering belief in this form of music, these rules that are going to, like, they are going to fix me. And it, you know, it felt at times, and this is, I'm, you know, I'm a little, I'm kind of generalizing a bit, but some of the people that I grew up with, I felt as if, you know, they were joining this movement, but they were not thinking for themselves.
Right.
They were buying into the groupthink in a way that clearly, don't get it twisted, is a far better series of beliefs, I think, to kind of align oneself with, you know, than evangelical Christianity, for example. I hope I'm not offending anybody listening to that. I think everybody's probably on the same page, right? However, you know, when one becomes extremely dogmatic about their worldview, you know, it doesn't leave much room for nuance. It doesn't, and I started to see people being ostracized from some of these scenes for not buying entirely into the movement, or for wearing the wrong shoes because they had a leather, you know, fucking like strap, or just the most ridiculous reasons to ostracize somebody or to chastise somebody were being kind of hoisted upon people who were, you know, 99% of the way there, you know? And, you know, that's not a reason. I'm not insinuating that one should kind of, like, anybody listening, I'm not trying to kind of like devalue what these movements have meant in people's lives, because they certainly meant a lot in my life. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, I've just never been a joiner. I don't join shit. And I think a lot of people need to join things to give themselves a sense of identity and purpose. And if that is saving one's life, that's great. But it doesn't necessarily mean that in doing so, that you stop questioning why you believe the things you believe.
Yeah.
Hey, y'all. Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And I think Ian would be the first one to try and distance himself from that and the sort of the interpretation of his words in Minor Threat. And it's interesting. Well, sorry, go on.
There were strong lyrics, not a manifesto necessarily. I mean, maybe he said manifesto every now and again, but like, you know, that's, yeah, they were interpretations of that and extreme applications of what he was saying in a way that
wasn't. Well, and we were. Yeah, I mean, in September, we got to go to the Discord house and Ian took us around. And it was, I mean, I said to Nick when we left the Discord house, I was like, I'm glad that 47-year-old Ben got to do this and not 27-year-old or 17-year-old Ben, because he would have lost his fucking mind. But to your point, Dave, like one of the things he was showing us, I'm sure, the archives, just the sheer amount of ephemera and history that is held in within that house and that he has been curating over the years is absolutely astounding. But he was showing us letters that were written to Minor Threat in like the early 80s, where kids were already debating him about straight edge, right? I mean, he still has these letters. This is over 40 years later. He's got these letters. And I can't imagine it gave me more respect than I even already had for him, for the poise he's been able to maintain around the subject, going all the way back to when he was only a couple years older than the people who were writing him these letters, right? And to be able to kind of respond to people in a measured way and to never get the message twisted, was pretty incredible to see.
I read a book years ago where they put sort of Jesus in the historical context and sort of stripped it out of the religious context and the spiritual context and just looked at this guy as this historical figure that existed at that time and sort of this like anti-state figure and very much removed from everything that it becomes. And it's interesting to look at Ian MacKaye and think maybe 30 years from now, people are going to start writing books about his life that never met him. And then 2,000 years later, what we are going to be talking about Ian MacKaye like.
Well, I mean, you know, there are a series of humans that have became famous for opposing systems of oppression. And if any of them that got popular enough, they all got killed for it, you know. And Jesus is one of those, and MLK is one of those. And, you know, and I think there's a lineage of being against systems of oppression and trying to alert people to the way that we're all pawns and protectors of systems of oppression if we're not thoughtful about how we approach our lives. And I, you know, growing up with Jesus in my head the way that I did and what appealed to me about him and that story, you know, it really is like, I'm not particularly into messianic figures or whatever, that seems pretty dangerous. But like, yeah, I think that Ian falls in line with, and I, you know, whatever, it's nothing's perfect, there's problems or whatever, but just even, I talked about this last time, but the idea of him looking at his work as being a custodian of this archive, which is an archive of the music scene in DC, and it's a garden that he's been planting and tending that's beautiful, botanical, like, oh, you know, massive thing. It lives in paper and recordings and things, but it's, those are such valuable things, and they are anti-systems of oppression. He's going about things in that way. I think that's the, you know, that's just one of the most helpful things a person could find and be for themselves, and then in Ian's case or other people's case, for other people through creative expression. Yeah.
Yeah, it's also it's interesting that someone would look at what they're doing as a teenager and say, this is important and this is worth holding on to. Like, both of you are so quick to dismiss post nasal drip and the guilty and Coolidge respectively. And but Ian still reissues the Teen Idols records and still,
he sounds sick.
You know, and I'm not saying they're not great. I have the Teen Idols record. I paid way more than I should have to get a Teen Idols record, but it's still ultimately just a thing made by a teenager that is amazing, but it's also amazing because it's been imbued with importance by what he did afterwards and by people telling me it's important since I got into this music. People being like, no, this is a holy text. You need to sacrifice all the money you made selling 200 records for it.
Do you think that, what do you think gave him the perspective to be, I don't know the answer to this question, I'm genuinely asking, the perspective to see the reality of what was happening with him and his bands and the importance of it? Was there something about the DC scene that, like, this, the Seattle scene, quote unquote, I think when, as we kind of came up into it, didn't feel like this cohesive communal thing. It had this feature of being very outward facing because of the bands that were huge from Seattle, many, many bands, you know, when I was trying to get a gig at the Crocodile for the first time, it felt like this insular club that I didn't or probably wouldn't ever belong to, but it feels like the DC scene was different, that it was cultivating things for years before that in the same spaces rather than, I mean, part of it has to do with the Seattle, like all ages, the teen dance ordinance, it really prevented a lot of that cohesion that might happen in unofficial spaces, non-bar spaces. We had the Velvet Elvis, was it OK Hotel all ages?
Yeah, it was OK Hotels all ages. Because there was a stipulation in the teen dance ordinance that if the venue is under 250 capacity, you didn't need this $1 million insurance policy. So OK Hotel is below that. And your question, Dave, which I don't obviously cannot answer because I was not there, but I find that a lot of these kind of seminal music scenes start out very small, that there are a handful of people and a handful of bands who just happen to be friends, and there is not there the cities in which these scenes are coalescing, they don't have the infrastructure to support a scene playing a particular style of music or live venues or whatever. So this coalition of young people creates it for themselves, right? And you know, that's the impression when I just as a fan of the history of this, you know, DC scene, it appears to be, or Olympia, whatever, it seems like this is how these things came together. It's like there was not an infrastructure to support this. So it was necessary to just build it. And by build it, we mean, well, we're going to do a show in my basement. And they're doing a show. Next week is a show in the living room. And we found this coffee shop that let us do shows. And my buddy is going to, he's going to lend us some money to press a record. And we're going to make them all. We're going to put them all together ourselves in the living room. You know, like we're going to have a party where we put these things together. And I think the mythology just grows and grows and grows from there. But I think oftentimes these scenes, they're very small, they're very insular, not because anybody's being left out, but because it's just like, we're just a bunch of freaks who want to do this weird music. Nobody else really wants to do it. So let's all just kind of come together and make it happen for ourselves. And maybe we'll kind of, you know, pull some scragglers in along the way.
I think it's also, and this is probably the reason Ian never wants to come on this show, is there's like another reading of it where DC was an area of a lot of wealth. There was a lot of means. SOA used to practice in the vice president's house. You know, there's cameras to record and document this stuff. And at a certain point, if you weren't Discord and you weren't doing it, in their way, it wasn't supported, I don't think.
Oh. Was it a pretty big umbrella that, or was there the sense of exclusivity that if we talked to bands who weren't quite in the in-group that...
Yeah, there's like a generational divide. Like you talk to some of the people in the bands, like Battery, they were sort of like the 90s, you know, hardcore bands that were going, that probably had moshing at their shows. Like it's just like a sort of different sensibility, right? And I think it's the difference between people in their 30s versus people in their early 20s and late teens, and kind of like how they view the world. And in this case, particularly punk, where when you're younger, you're like, yeah, let's be fucking crazy. Let's have moshing at the shows. Let's like, you, there's just a different energy, right? And I just think, yeah, like there's, and even kids today that are from that scene, there's not like a lot of connection, short of reverence for the stuff that Discord does, right? Like it's not like Discord's putting out Turnstile records or stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which, and I don't fault them for that at all, because at a certain point you surrender the zeitgeist to another generation, and it's not necessarily your role to shepherd it. And
yeah,
and it kind of goes badly sometimes when people try and stay past the
well road. And also it's like, you know, I mean, the, you know, it seems like a lot of the ways in which bands either are expected to or choose to promote themselves don't necessarily gel with what we collectively would kind of call like the Discord ethic, right? I mean, it's just a very different world today than it was in the early 90s, where, you know, all three of us, I'm sure, on the Zoom would like look at the back of a Discord record and be like, oh shit, $8 postpaid. Like, let me write down this address and send them $8, and then the CD shows up or the record shows up, right? I mean, like, of the many radical things that Discord did, you know, to be basically be saying fuck you to the record store that you are in, looking at this Discord record that says, hey, you can get this for cheaper from us. If they're over, if this store is charging you $14 for this, you can get it for $8 from us directly, is a pretty ballsy thing to do, right? And it's a pretty like aggressively, not so much anti-capitalist, but certainly it almost falls outside of like what one would consider like the proper way to deal with that, right? You know, like not the proper way to deal with it, but the more cordial way to kind of let people know that you can pre-order it from us directly. You know what I mean? I've never since have seen a label do that, where they're just saying like, hey, you don't have to pay $14 for this. You can get it for cheaper from us if you just order it, because this is how much this should cost.
Well, the UK labels would do pay no more than on the fronts of their records, and they would be like, pay no more than $4.99, $3.99. And I think that's what, because I think obviously Ian's a nerd for this music. That was my favorite part about punishing him at the Discord house, is just how deep his taste and knowledge goes for that early punk rock stuff. And yeah, like I'm not detracting from him in any way, because, you know, I think Turnstile now has blossomed into a completely different kind of band than a Discord band. But early on, 10 years ago, when they were starting, it wasn't like there was a Turnstile Discord split release. And not that there should have been, because it's not really Ian's place to kind of be that guy, I think, for DC in the present day. But it's just interesting how there is sort of like, when you talk to people from the scene, how different sort of the interpretations of things go. Like Tree People, a band I always loved, thought were a great band, till talk to people from your area, I had no idea how important that band was, and kind of went back and rediscovered them. And they're like the unspoken great band of the Pacific Northwest, even though I guess they're technically not from the Pacific Northwest.
Well, we'll adopt them a bit. They played in Seattle all the time. I mean, I'll never forget hearing Liquid Boy from Something Vicious for Tomorrow when I was like 14 or 15, whatever, on like the radio, on the local show, it was as if I'd been searching for all along, you know, this kind of this combination of like, you know, just kind of just the angular guitar work, but also just the melodic sense that especially Doug Marsh was bringing to that band. I don't know what he ever went on to do, but I must have been pretty great. but yeah, no, I mean, they did a reunion show just earlier this year, and a friend of mine from high school and I went and saw them, and they sounded great. And it was just another reminder of, like, you know, they certainly haven't been written out of the Northwest music story, but I think they definitely deserve more attention and more a proper you know, reevaluation. And maybe that starts with getting those records reissued at some point.
Is that there's not been a numero group? That would be a good candidate for that. I don't know how everybody feels about that stuff, but yeah, just some sort of framing where it's like, here's a box set of like a super important band from that had influence that, you know, far reaches, outreaches, you know, how known they are.
I think K Records, it feels like some of those records have been reissued. I know K had reissued Guilt, Regret, and Embarrassment. But to my knowledge, and maybe just because I haven't looked into this, I don't know of a reissue of Something Vicious for Tomorrow, Time Horror, which seems like that's the for me, that's the record. That's the record that needs a real proper advance. But maybe there has been, and I'm just not aware of it, or it's ones in the works, because it seems like at this point, yeah, like a numero group style kind of repress would be wonderful. I mean, I think what they've been doing to kind of bring a lot of the, what numero has been doing to bring a lot of the 90s kind of post rock and kind of, you know, punk adjacent stuff back into the fray has been pretty exciting.
What they have done for bands that put out records that were printed on manila envelopes cannot be
appreciated. Yeah.
But it's interesting with the Tree People, because they kind of come about in like a weird period that I think super underdocumented in Pacific Northwest music, you know, in particular, I guess Seattle music and Seattle area music, where post Nirvana, post grunge explosion, everything that kind of comes out about that. There's like this sort of like perceived death of Seattle, but then when you break it down, like Pedro the Lion, you know, Death Cab for Cutie, but also Modest Mouse, Murder City Devils, MXPX, there's like Carp. There's just so much cool stuff that's kind of coming out. Sun, there's just like wild stuff that's kind of like bubbling up during that period where, yeah, like maybe commercially it didn't hit the Nirvana, Pearl Jam sales heights, because I guess the industry had changed so much by that point. But I think like influence wise, it's amazing the stuff that came out of that next era. And I think Tree People seems like almost like a bridge band or part of that bridge period.
Yeah, because those records were coming out, I mean, like late 80s, early 90s, I think. So, and I think by 93, 94, those guys were done. But yeah, I completely agree with you. I think like there was this, you know, the understandable emphasis on grunge nationwide and worldwide made a lot of sense. But I felt like, you know, Tree People was kind of, they were a perfect distillation of this kind of like kids who grew up listening to hardcore, but also loved like what would probably be like early Dinosaur Jr. and like kind of more melodic stuff, and kind of like the melding of these two things in this way that was still really gritty. And like, you know, a Tree People record is kind of, it's a little kind of schizophrenic. It's like, you know, you have a Doug song that's really catchy and kind of poppy, and then you have a Scott Small John song that's like a classic, like, you know, Turkey Carver, you know, beat, like doobot, 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 but you know, one of those like really kind of like fast tunes, but it has that kind of like melodic kind of like angular guitar thing going. Yeah, they were just kind of weaving between these two worlds. And I think there was a lot of stuff going on in Portland, Seattle, Boise, that was kind of in that vein, you know, that was like, as I say, like not, certainly not grunge, but like punk adjacent, but was kind of pulling on some more melodic threads that maybe some of the other, that was kind of maybe would have been seen as being somewhat uncool in the earlier days of punk, you know.
The question I asked about Ian and his sense of perspective and confidence, and Ben, your answer seemed to speak to community, and there's this, and even what you're saying, there was sort of this outward facing Seattle you know, scene or sound or whatever that was like national, international. And I don't really think that things percolate and grow in that environment. Like in the, when it's like, you know, once you're outward, like, I feel like things between people, they seed each other and they grow when you're spending time in that communal setting. And we got the benefit of that as kids. Part of, I think, some people, and I was one of these, and I don't think Ian was, I was looking for validation. And the way that it works, that validation seems to come from national distribution, the ability to tour nationally. Like, that was a major goal. I think a lot of times it can undercut the very crucial part of any development of music in oneself or in one's community. And that is that communal aspect that, for me, touring did have the effect of dulling my communal experience at a certain point, because you're out all the time and you're not going to all the parties. You missed, you know, when Blonde Redhead came that one time and everybody saw that one show. Or for me, it was Bedhead. When Bedhead came through and played their last shows in Seattle in 1998, I was on my first tour. And
I was at those shows.
Son of a bitch. Like, there's something about being home, and touring is obviously crucial, and it, depending on what you're doing, and it's a major thing. But there is something about where we all found this was with our friends and our towns. And, you know, with Discord, how many of those bands have like a strong national presence? I don't think it was, maybe you could speak to this, but didn't seem like a huge percentage.
Shudder to Think, right? Like, that would be the only one that kind of tried to break out of the system, and it didn't work out.
And it can seem oppressive in a certain way because people are trying to break out, but really it speaks to the incubator that all this stuff happened in, which was these deep, intense, storied, generational, communal interactions that are rarely seen or written about besides the people that are in them. And so, like, we look at these times that we had within this space, and they're just crucial. And I think that it's tempting now because it's like, you know, you don't want to be like, there's a sense that I had that I don't want to be provincial. I don't want to be from a place. Like, I want to be accessible to other people, or to not be like a hillbilly, you know, stuck with my sort of limited regional perspective. And now I look back and think, like, oh, that sucks. Like, that's the most valuable thing you can have, is like, your record collection is a regional perspective in a way. Your friends' record collections, what you like to talk about, the bands that play, like, all these things are so crucial to our development as people who know ourselves, have this perspective. You know, I have this perspective now, but I wish I had it when I was a kid. But I just wanted validation, you know, in a way that, I don't think it made me make music that wasn't true, but it caused me to spend less time in that communal space and that communal incubator than I might have otherwise if I understood the value of it, and not just trying to hurry up and, you know, like Ben was saying, like, we were gone. We left.
Yeah, I was going to jump in, Dave, and say that just what you were saying earlier. I think one of the many reasons that, you know, and I'm just, you know, you correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, but I feel like one of the many reasons that Pedro the Lion and Death Cab bonded the way we did in the early days is because, like, unlike a lot of our contemporaries in Seattle, for myriad reasons, you know, we were on the road a lot. And, you know, there were a lot of bands that we came up with that were kind of like, you know, drinking at the cha-cha and like hanging out around Capitol Hill, talking about what they were going to do, or when we do this, I'm going to do that. And, you know, while people were kind of sitting around talking about what they were going to do, like, we were out doing it. And I'm not saying that to kind of be self-aggrandizing, but just a statement of fact. And so to Dave's point, we weren't there for like, you know, we didn't get written up a lot in like, you know, the Stranger or the Rocket or whatever, like scene stuff, like, because we weren't hanging out at these places because we were out on the road. Like we missed out, for better or for worse, you know, I think in some ways for better and in some ways for worse, we were less present in the scene on a daily basis because we were on the road. We were doing shows.
Freddy Van.
In a van. Yeah. And like I said, I'm not trying to sell a bootstraps narrative for Death Cab and Cradle of the Lion, but you know, the fact was it just like, yeah, it's like we were kind of, I would never say we were ostracized by anybody, but we certainly were not in with the quote unquote cool kids because we just weren't around to hang out with them. Like we just were out, you know, we weren't like bartending at the cool bar, working at the coffee shop, like on Capitol Hill. We were out on fucking tour all the time, you know?
And also making records, like there was a sense that I heard from people around, like, once we get this together, we'll make our record, or once we do this, we'll make our record. And I just, my attention deficit disorder, whatever that I've always dealt with, like I couldn't focus on anything, but it was just like, I just need to make it now. Like I don't have the resources that I maybe should have. And for me, that was a turn on, especially here. I mean, honestly, that was a huge part of Death Cab too. It wasn't just the song craft and the part writing and the arrangements, which like really thrilled me, but also they were making their records on an 8-track reel to reel, you know, or whatever they had, like, and so there was a DIY aspect to it, which isn't, I don't have like a religious fervor for, I just have a prep. I just want to make stuff. And I was too ADHD to save for $100 skateboard. Like I'm not going to get a $6,000 rig to make my record on. I've got this mic and this mic. I've got these drums and I point them at them and you move them around till they feel right. And I knew other people wanted to make like good sounding records or whatever they would say, but I didn't care about that. I just wanted to express this thing. And, you know, we were on a pace for, you know, a long time, putting out records in similar time frames and hearing the way that all went, like it was like, I get to do this thing. I'm not gonna, you know, it was just like, let's do it. Like I wanna play. And that was the other thing too. If you're making records and you're touring, you're playing music all the time. And whether I knew it or not, that's an extremely healing thing. And I needed to be playing music. I'm playing drums in Pedro now again. Not again, I never did, but like I put on the record. Sitting there and just like working my emotions out every night, like on a drum set. And you're doing it on this tour still with the Postal Service, but it's therapeutic. It's good for my brain and my body.
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
I'm just so fucked up all the time. Like it makes things better. And so that's a part of it too. Like hanging out's fun, but like hitting stuff and making loud sounds, like that is good for you, you know?
Well, yeah, and I have to jump in and just say that, you know, we were so blessed to have Chris Walla in the band for the first 14 years where he just brought this ethic of like, yeah, I'm going to borrow some equipment or buy a track and we're going to make our own records. We don't need to go to a studio and this and that. And like, recently I heard somebody attempt to frame DIY as anti-capitalist. And I was like, no, that's actually entirely incorrect. Like, we made our own records so we could make money off of the records when they actually came out. Like we made a record for $200 so that like we didn't have to be in debt to the record company. Like it wasn't exactly a tit for tat. Like we DIY'd it to make money, but the idea was like, we don't have money to go to a studio. Like this isn't a political choice. This is quite literally an economic one. And as soon as we clear the $200 we cost to make this record, hopefully when the record starts selling, we'll make a little bit of money. They can help us like pay for our practice space or whatever, you know?
Yeah. And then you make the next record at the practice space and then your practice space is a cool studio. I mean, it's super inspiring. And that's the thing is like, you're not seeing money. You're not seeing means. You're seeing several imaginations put together to try to make the best thing that you can make with what you have. And when that is, we have the facts and we're voting yes, it's like, yeah, what is wrong with this model? Nothing. Like, this is how it should feel. That was, yeah. I mean, hearing, you know, Airplanes was sick. I loved it. I think I've ripped it off in ways, but like when We Have the Facts came out, I just couldn't believe, like, it just, so imagination, seeing imagination just like crystallized on this, you know, on demand. I could just play it anytime I want. It's,
well, thanks, man. I also want to back up and say, like, I want to be very clear that Death Cab did not make Run Records to make money. I want to be very clear about that. But just that, I want to be very clear about that. But my point more is just that, like, you know, yeah, it's like we were blessed to have somebody in the band who had the drive and talent and creativity. And we also made We Have the Facts and We're Voting Yes in Nick's mom's house, because we had no money, you know, and thankfully, because we made this record for no money, you know, a year and a half later, Barsuk would thanks to a very generous royalty split, we were able to kind of quit our jobs. Yeah. We were able to quit working temp jobs, and we were able to kind of make this, you know, as I've maybe said on this podcast, but I certainly said it a gajillion times before. I remember in late 2000 getting a royalty check for $4,000. And being like, holy shit, $4,000, amazing. This will pay my rent for the next 3 months. And okay, and we have a tour in 2 months. So like, here we go, you know, here we go. And we would not have been able to kind of make this our job had it not been for doing it ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, I was blessed to be able to sit down with two such talented, driven people as yourselves. And anytime you guys want to come back on this podcast, together or separate, because there's lots more we could talk about, you are both very much welcome.
That's awesome. Thank you for having
us. Awesome. Thanks, Damien.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.